subject tonight is the flight of the prophet.
Chapter 19 of the first book of Kings. Let us read from verse 1. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain all the prophets with a sword. You can sense by those early remarks in our chapter that this man recited the remarkable events of chapter 18 with a bias. I don't think I am misinterpreting the mind of the Spirit of God when I say that. And I suppose most of my fellow saints have already learned that the way you recite events will greatly influence the thinking of those who listen to you. If you recite events with a bias, be sure of this, you communicate that to those who are listening. We must take heed how we repeat stories. Let us do our utmost to give facts and lead people make their own assessment. Now verse 2. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree, a bush with very bitter berries. Sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die, and said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my father. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, arise and eat. I beseech my fellow saints to go through the life of Elijah and notice the frequent command, arise. Over and over it occurs, and you will find something very interesting for your soul's instruction. Arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baked on the coal, and a cruse of water at his head, and he did eat and drink, and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time, and touched him, and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he arose and did eat and drink, and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the mount of God. And he came thither unto the cave. You will notice your marginal reading. The cave, and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and said unto him, what doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of the hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, have thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And he said, go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the door passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And as to the wind and earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake of fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle, went out, and stood in the entering in of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him, and said, What doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And the Lord said unto him, Go, return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when thou comest, anoint Israel to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Idel-Meholah, shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Israel shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I have left me 10,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which has not kissed him. May God bless to us his precious word. And so we come to the passage where we read the collapse of this remarkable man of God. And we heard him pray a very doleful prayer. Needless to say, my fellow saints have learned long ago that the life of Elijah contains a record of his five prayers. We all know the prayer for discipline upon the people of God. We are indebted to James for the information about this man's prayerful exercise that transpired long before he appeared in the court, as we observed him in chapter 17, verse 1. He was guided very definitely by the Deuteronomy scripture in that request, and as we have reminded ourselves, he was confident that God would answer his prayer. Afterwards, of course, in chapter 17, you have his request for light. The widow's son was restored in answer to the prayers of this man of God. I sometimes wonder if his faith did not go beyond the faith of Abraham. The writer to the Epistle to the Hebrews tells us that Abraham believed God that he would raise up even from the dead. But as we all know, the extent of the man's trial did not embrace death itself. In this case, the prophet beseeches his God to bring life when the son of the widow had died. You can judge for yourself, beloved fellow saints, what you think about that proposition. Then, of course, you have the prayer for vindication of the divine character in chapter 18. We looked at that last night. When a man enters into the presence of God and argues, if I may be allowed to use that language, the character of God in his petitions, he becomes effective in his intercession. It's a good thing to be frank with God and tell him that you expect answers because of what he is in himself. Then following this, you have the prayer of this dear man for the refreshing rain. God answered his prayer. We noticed last night that that's a beautiful type of the blessing of Pentecost. After the ascent and exaltation of our glorious Lord, who overcame the force who struggled against him upon the cross, you have the blessing of the Spirit of God. It's a sure mark of the exaltation of Christ that the believer has the Spirit of God in this age. Now you come to this prayer of chapter 19, and some have called it Elijah's unanswered prayer. You will notice that his request is, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my father." God did not take away his life. Therefore, some have rightly said it is Elijah's unanswered prayer. But of course the keen prophetic student will say, "Wait one moment, sir. He will appear again in earth's affairs and he will die." Now, are we going to enter into anything of a controversial nature? Perhaps one of the witnesses of Revelation chapter 11 is this very outstanding prophet of God. And you will all know that passage reveals that God will yet vindicate the resurrection of his Son in an apostate world by raising witnesses from the dead. Will the world say in the future, "Men and women have been hoodwinked too long. We shall defeat forever, finally, this foolish notion of resurrection from the dead, hence the bodies are left in the open marketplace"? God answers the challenge. My brethren, in the resurrection of the witnesses, whoever they are, God will vindicate the glorious, triumphant resurrection of his Son. Now I hope you don't think we're in the realm of speculation. You can judge for yourself how you must tabulate this fifth prayer of dear Elijah. We are somewhat astounded when we listen to the dear man pray this way. Is this really the man who made intercession before God? Is this the man who is the messenger of God to that wicked court of Ahab? Is this the man who fought single-handed against the hundreds of Baal priests? Yes, it's the same man, all right. And I'm somewhat glad to note that. It confirms what is said in the epistle of James, that he's a man of like passions as ourselves. Sometimes, you know, we are apt to fall down and adore these Old Testament worthies and think them to be distinctive and above the normal emotions of the human race. That is not so. They were mighty men for God because they were in touch with God. Although they were of the same stuff as ourselves, God used them, and that ought to be encouragement for us. Now I want you to notice the spiritual collapse and trace with me the reasons for the collapse. And afterwards, we must look at the way God so marvelously restored his servant. How good it is to remember that there's no dear saint of God beyond the moral recovery of God. I suppose that this, on the surface, is
is a warning that faith is never weaker than immediately after victory. Did you catch that, my fellow saint? That moment of elation, that moment of jubilation is the perilous moment. And you may think, I have made achievement. Beware, that's the weakest moment of your faith. I take it the story is inserted in the sacred word to warn us of that important spiritual faith. Dear Mr. Steen used to say very frequently in his ministry, some of these things stick, don't they? It takes a steady hand to carry a full cup. Did not Abraham realize that when he returned from the slaughter of the king? Had he achieved a marvelous victory over the confederacy of the Babylonian people? Yes, God gave him the victory. But upon his return, he is confronted with another king, the new king of Sodom. Give me these souls and take the goods to thyself. That was far more treacherous, a snare for Abraham, than the engagement in open battle with the king. Is it necessary for me to ask, was it not far more dangerous for David at rest in Jerusalem than with his armies in battle? You know the grievous collapse of that dear man, all because of relaxation, which is ever perilous for the people of God. Perhaps, beloved brethren and sisters, we are putting our finger on one of the weaknesses of present-day Christian living. Are we resting on our laurels? Are we thinking that everything is well? Beware, my fellow saint, that may be the very condition that Satan is using to keep you back from ardent witness for God. There it is. It lies as a warning in the sacred word of this principle. But let us ask ourselves, why is it that the dear man collapsed? Let's make an investigation, if we can, by the help of the Spirit of God. And let us be frank and fair. Will you agree with me when I say that this man was utterly fatigued spiritually? Physically. Perhaps I ought to emphasize that more. Think of the arduous task that he had accomplished. That long day upon the Mount Carmel. Think of that run. That 15-mile run before the chariot of Ahab. Is not that enough to drain a man of physical energy? And with it, you must couple the important fact that he had passed through a time of intense exercise. The tension of his being could not be measured. You know that any arduous task drains you of nervous energy. That's the kind of thing that happened. I am informed that the paratrooper, when he jumps, takes out of his system 24 hours nervous energy. Those people who know more about it will put me right. But I have known in experience, and I'm talking to people of experience, that when anything of a very acute nature arises in the life, then nervous energy is sucked away. The moment there is relaxation and some relenting, then you feel the effect. That's why a woman can nurse her child for hours and hours and seemingly have endless energy. But the moment there's a turn for the better, the relaxation comes in and she feels, in the language of my dear wife, as wet as a wet rag. Are we prepared to recognize that the prophet of God suffered that experience? Keep that in your mind. Then the next thing, was not his effort a companionless effort? Has he not fought single-handed against these worshippers of Baal? Oh, but he had a servant. Well now, having a servant is not companionship. You may have company, but to have companionship is a different thing. I hope my fellow saints can see the fine difference. You can live in London amidst the thousands and millions there and be extremely lonely. Mark you, I know many dear saints of God who have moved into the city and have found themselves absolutely isolated amidst the thousands there. Why? They have no companionship. Have you ever worked for God alone without any support? Mark you, Christian fellowship is a great thing when you think of this. Bear this in mind before we make some application. The man is utterly fatigued physically. He has fought single-handed. That's no easy task. Then Thursday, he's a man with disappointed hope. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. Why do you say that? He has listened to the cheers on Mount Carmel. He has heard the people cry, "The Lord is God." But dear me, events have turned quickly. And he perceives that the people who shout very loudly on the mount are not prepared to shout for him. Oh, my brethren, men will enter into your victories quite easily and do their utmost to share them, but they won't share your sorrows and your hardships and your struggles. And have you worked hard to achieve a certain result and then found only an hour or so afterwards that what you thought was achievement was just surface veneer work? This is what this good man experienced. And there's nothing that can knock the bottom out of a man more than this kind of thing. How many dear men, may I say this kindly, have lost their health all because they have found the saints of God turning in half a moment, although they've labored almost all their lives to bring them into the pathway of obedience to the will of God. And must I add to that, that the dear man had exaggerated his own importance? Is the word correct? Did you notice more than once he says, "I"? And mark you, that's emphatic. "I, only I am left." I think, in all fairness to the narrative, I must include that. I'm fully aware that I'm speaking of a much greater man. But brethren, I'm respecting the candid revelations of the Spirit of God. How wonderfully faithful is the word to depict for us characters without dressing them up. That's one thing that's marvelous about our Bible. Absolutely frank. Its candor is in itself an evidence that it comes from God. God ever analyzes a man with perfect analysis. He had exaggerated his own importance. These, I suggest, are the causes of the dear man's collapse. And because that is so, I think that we ought to draw some lessons from these facts. Is it true that the man suffered physical fatigue? Then it's necessary for the saints of God to take care of their bodies.
Now, please don't think when I say this that I'm asking you to run to all the fields and football fields of the world. I'm not talking about that. Don't you misunderstand me, my fellow saints. I don't want to be misunderstood, so I'm going to speak plainly. But I do think this, that there are many conditions that can only be answered by the ministries of a doctor. For they relate these conditions not so much to the spiritual realm, but to the physical realm. Perhaps, beloved fellow saints, we have to analyze ourselves a little more carefully than we do. And instead of talking about the despondency being a spiritual thing, it probably arises out of a fatigued physical state. And mark you, there's a closer relationship between the body and the spirit than some of us are prepared to recognize. If I am not correct, will you please help me to understand what is meant in the Gospels? And when he was hungered, then Satan struck. He knew the weakness of the Lord's physical frame. And he does the same thing with the people of God nowadays. I am sure of this. If I do not meet with full agreement from my fellow saints, I know that they will be compelled to accept this as part answer, at least, of some of the heavy problems we are confronted with cases of despondency. So, my brother, remember, you're a steward of that body of yours, and you must treat it as the gift of God and not abuse it. Now, you see, the door's open for me to say quite a lot. But, my beloved fellow saints, I'm giving you credit to make applications of principles to yourselves. I'm sure you will. If we are anxious to live to the glory of God, we shall recognize that the offering of the body in true consecration sacrifice is to be the very best. And is it so that the man fought single-handed? That helps me to appreciate Christian fellowship. For two are better than one. We've all seen the great point in the Gospel of Matthew and Mark, haven't we, about the call of the disciples. I always take joy in pointing out in the Gospel of Matthew, you have the disciples set before you in pairs. They are sent forth in pairs in Mark 6, but their call is single, chapter 3, and separate every name. We are all responsible to God, the servants, individually responsible. But in the service of God, we are to learn to move together, for the warmth of Christian fellowship is in itself a stimulus in the things of God. The locusts go forth by bands. That's what is written in the book of Proverbs. Mark you, one locust wouldn't trouble me, but if I were in an area where locust plagues were rife, I would dread the locust plague, for the myriads of locusts would cause great devastation. I hope we can see the value of Christian fellowship. I've told the saints more than once about Mr. Moody answering one of these individuals who called himself an isolationist. He was one of those fellows who did not believe in throwing his lot in with anybody. We call them nowadays in plain terms freelancers. He wasn't prepared to take responsibility in any community. And Mr. Moody heard his viewpoint, although he was being entertained by it. So Mr. Moody simply took the tongs from the companion set and removed one life hole from the half, put it on the half, and returned the companion set tongs. All he did was look at the call, and so did his good horse. And after a moment he said, I see it. I see it. When the call was left with the other burning coals in the fire, it burned and it glowed and it gave its warmth. The moment it was removed and separated, it lost its glow and warmth. And that's what happens with many a child of God. There are some of the Lord's people who grumble because they do not find in the assembly fellowship the warmth that they They expect, but they never think about giving any themselves. We had one sister in Luton, she always had a grouse about the lack of fellowship. Needless to say, before the meetings were over, she was on her feet and walked out. She hardly spoke to anyone, and after a continued practice of this, she wondered why the people were so cold toward her. Can you imagine that kind of thing? My fellow saints, remember the scripture says, he that hath friends is friendly. And is it true that the man had disappointed hopes? Well, now you must build up your hopes and count your chickens before they hatch. That's an old proverb, isn't it? Oftentimes we have been reminded by brethren that the men counted the fish in the shore in John 21. And perhaps it's a good thing for us all to keep that principle in mind. It will save us from elements of disappointment. And of course, if this man exaggerated his own importance, then we must be reminded, brethren, that it's not to work for ourselves we are called. A man can do good things and great things and exploit simply to glorify himself and to develop a prestige and influence among the people of God. A man's motive must always be the glory of God and not the exaltation of sin. You will agree with me? These are the elements of the dear man's collapse. I leave them. Let's trace the dealings of God with them in the remainder of the chapter. You will see that the chapter deals with three things. First of all, you have the meal. Afterwards, you have the mountain. And thirdly, you have the message. Will you allow me to use homiletics? Now look at the meal with me and learn what is taught in the provision of a meal. I want you to notice verse 5 and see how it opens. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him. Then that registers for me divine patience. The man had been allowed to run away, travel very many miles. He rests under the juniper tree. God allows all this. But then, the passage says, which registers for us the lovely grace of God in dealing with him so patiently. We are so impetuous. We would have condemned him. Running away, are you? You've made a very bold stand, and your claims have been very high. You're contradicting it. We are very good in pouring scorn on people who collapse. My brethren, the Lord does not behave like that. He's a God of patience. Then, let each heart in this meeting remember that the patience of God is not exhausted with our own. You may give up many a man for a hopeless case. Remember, there's one in God's presence who is the living high priest, and patience is expressed in his lovely ministry. Then, that's divine patience. Look again at verse 6. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coal, and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. Ah, can you sense some relief? What is this? Divine provision. Has God made provision for his servant? Yes. And to see the force of this, brethren, we have to compare it with what happened in chapter 17. When the man was in touch with God, those black servants of the heavens were good enough to minister to him. They became his bakers and his butchers. Yes, but now the man is out of touch with God. God makes provision for him. And an angel is the attendant. I think this is lovely. Can you see, beloved fellow saints, in this wonderful action, God's provision and patience in grace?
Do remember that God will adopt extraordinary means to restore his people when there are extraordinary circumstances. And of course, when you come to verse 7, you discern the divine purpose in it. And the angel came again the second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." Can you see God's allowance of this man? Shall I use God's permission? He has no word for this journey, and yet God makes provision for it. My brethren, don't think that every provision of God is for an evidence that you are in the will of God. If that heart of yours is set on a particular course, the only way God can deal with that condition of soul is to give you what you desire. And that gift is a merciful means of correction. Oftentimes you find that in your Bible. I know it's put in a very grim fashion in the Psalms pertaining to the Israelites. I don't think that it is as heavy a matter in this man's life as in the history of the Israelites. They desired meat, and God sent leanness into their souls by providing the meat that they desired. Beware of your desires, my beloved fellow saints, for remember, if you persist in them, God will allow them, and you'll be sorry. I don't know of a more severe form of judgment of our God in his governmental dealings with his people. What then is written over the meal and all that is said of it? Very simply, the invincibility of divine consolation. Oh, brethren, to see how God dealt with his failing servant does bring comfort to the heart. Remember, the God of Elijah is your God. Now look at the mountain. What transpired there? Horeb, as you know. And I drew attention to the definite article in verse 9, and he came thither unto the cave. What is this? The very spot where Moses had been. And he's virtually saying, "Oh yes, Moses suffered the same kind of thing that I suffered. And I'm going there." Surprising, you know, how you can have a joy out of a grudge. Have you discerned that? Now what happened? There were manifestations of divine power in the mount. I wonder, do we understand what is meant by the record that we are now looking at? Can you see again what transpired? Please look at verse 11. "And he said, Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord." But the Lord was not in the wind. "And after the wind an earthquake." And the Lord was not in the earthquake. "And after the earthquake a fire." But the Lord was not in the fire. Do we understand that passage? What is the implication? Let me say, manifestations of power are not necessarily God. What did you say? Shall I repeat it? Manifestations of power are not necessarily God. Once a child of God is aware of that, they will be helped to walk consistently in their Christian pathway. There are some of the Lord's people completely captivated by manifestations of power, and that's the reason why they engage very many hours of their lives in unspiritual action. Now, I cannot interpret that much better. I could allude to a lot of things, but that would only fog your mind. Grasp the principle. Remember, my beloved fellow saints, that manifestations of power are not necessarily manifestations of God himself. So what happened? You will see when the still small voice was heard, verse 13 reads, and it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering of the cave. That still small voice was more effective to bring that man to the mouth of the cave than the demonstrations of mighty power in the creation. Now, the lesson is this. For the man himself, Elijah, you have argued that the land needs a sweeping wind. You have argued that what is required is a mighty earthquake, shake the people. You have argued that what is essential is a baptism of fire. My work is not accomplished that way. Don't you think that demonstrative stuff is the thing that moves the hearts of men? Your own reaction will illustrate to you what you ought to look for from the people to whom you are ministering. My brethren, this is important. We can resort, you know, to fleshly means to accomplish spiritual ends. God will never give his blessing and sanction such a thing. Remember that the flesh can stand for truth, but God will never vindicate that. What I want you to see is this, that God does not accomplish his work through the passionate excitement of men. He never does. God ever works through spiritual channels. Are we prepared to accept that? One writer has pointed out very beautifully, do you hear the rush of those mighty orbs through the universe? They're going in that pathway appointed by God without any sound, as far as we are concerned. We have seen the winter coming, and the trees are now all bare. But very soon the spring will come, and in a few weeks you'll find those now bare trees covered with lovely foliage. Do you hear any noise? And have you seen the snowflakes falling today? Tell me, were you deafened? God covered Belfast this day in a mantle of white without any noise. I'd never forget when my beloved brother-in-law was dying. He was telling me how the Lord had so graciously provided for him on his dying bed. And he says, oh, Fred, he said, the Lord's provision has been dropping as gentle as snowflakes. I've never forgotten that. My brethren, don't forget that God never works through the passionate excitement of men. He works in his own irresistible way. The gentleness of God is the might of God. I've seen from the book of Matthew many years ago that marvelous contrast that struck by the evangelist in chapter 3. Do you remember how he announces the Messiah? He's coming as a woodsman. He's coming as a baptizer. He's coming as an agriculturist whose fan is in his hand. How strong those figures are given by John the Baptist. But before the chapter closes, you have, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And the Spirit of God descends upon him as a gentle dove. My brethren, the power of Christianity is its weakness. Don't forget that must characterize your service. If you wish to be effective for God, don't depend, I sincerely beseech you, on the passionate excitement of men that never accomplishes the work of God. I've been sore at heart at some of the Lord's people, captivated by the demonstrative evangelism that has taken place in our land of late, and then left without any genuine results and abiding character. My fellow believer, I do beseech you to think again of the ways of God. Look at the Acts of the Apostles, and you'll find that the preaching of the gospel took shape in a very much different fashion than what we are witnessing nowadays. I hope you see what I mean. Beloved fellow saints, the mountain teaches us that God is absolutely mighty in his gentleness.
And the prophet is taught the impotency of his impetuosity. Now, finally, look at the message. The message of verse 15 onwards. There are three things I want you to notice quickly. First, in verse 15 onwards, you have three anointings. Anoint Hazael and Jehu and Elisha. Three anointings, three different men. Israel, the ruthless destroyer of Israel. Jehu, the fierce reformer. Elisha, the gentle father. What a variety of instruments God has. The anointings reveal to us that God has inexhaustible reserve. Don't you listen to this gloomy talk that no servants today, like the old days. We thank God for the men of the past day. And we are bound to bow in his presence and thank him for his glorious sovereignty in raising up men to meet the conditions of their day. But don't you think, my fellow saints, that your God has run out of supply. Your God has inexhaustible reserve. The three anointings taught Elijah this important fact. I hope we shall take encouragement from that. But look, verse 17 says, "And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of his ill shall Jehu slay. And him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay." What does this teach us? The irresistibility of divine dealings, of course. If you think, Elijah, that these people are evaded by divine dealings, think again. I have instruments to accomplish my judgment. If a man escapes one phase of dealing, he will not escape the next. If perchance he escapes the second, he will not escape the third. One man has rightly said, God's nets have not all the same measure. You may go through the first, my brother, but remember, the governments of God are absolutely irresistible. You know the reason why the Israelites spent 70 years in captivity, don't you? They try to deny the land of his rest. God said, you can't do that. And so away into captivity they went. And the land had a Sabbath. God will have his way. What is the meaning of the book of Numbers? Why is it that you have a wearisome reading, if I may so speak, in order to impress my fellow believers? It's not wearisome reading, is it? But you will find that the end of the book of Numbers repeats what is found at the beginning. Why? God is saying to the second generation what he said to the first. In other words, he's telling them, my will must be done. So, brethren, we should be wise if we submit to our God and say, thy will be done. It will save us unnecessary experiences and experiences that are fruitless. So, in this world they shall not escape. You have the irresistibility of divine dealing. Now look at verse 18. Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the deeds which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. What is this? Did the prophet say, I am left? God says, my good prophet, dear Elijah, I want you to see there are 7,000 as well as yourself. Can you see in that the inevitability of God's triumph over apostasy? The 7,000 in Israel had not bowed their knees.
And so Elijah must have been eventually encouraged. Amidst all the mixture of feelings that he knew at this time, God communicated to him a blessed thing. Elijah, my purposes cannot be defeated. Press on, go with her. I hope, beloved fellow saints, that as we have looked at the meal, the mountain, and the messages, that we shall all be encouraged, irrespective of our failures, to go on with God more determinedly, with that fixed heart, so that we do his will and acknowledge him as our sovereign, compassionate God. May he bless his precious word to us.